Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. In just a moment, we'll be talking through all the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And then it's on to this week's sponsor interview with Sally Carson of Duo Security. And that interview is an absolute cracker. Sally runs product design at Duo, which employs one designer for every five engineers. And the idea behind that ratio is to make products that people can actually use easily. A crazy idea. And Sally joins the program a little bit later on to talk through what the design process actually looks like in her job. And yeah, I think there are some real teachable moments in that interview for all of us. It's good stuff, so do stick around for that one. That is coming up, of course, after the week's news discussion with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, we're going to begin this week's news with a statement from RIPE's Network Coordination Centre.
Yes, RIPE, who run the IP address allocation for Europe, have announced they have finally run out of IPv4 space. They've given out the last set of addresses. They've got a waiting list now for people who returned addresses when they've gone out of business, that kind of thing. But essentially, there is no V4 left in Europe. And actually, it's kind of behind schedule. We thought it was going to happen earlier than this.
Yeah, but, no, I mean, that's the thing that immediately leapt out to me as well. It's like, hang on, weren't we running out of these when I was working at ZDNet like back in 2003?
Well, yeah, they've been really rationing and squeezing, you know, the maximum amount of the last few networks they have kicking around, and much the same as, you know, the other registries have around the world. It's getting really hard to get big allocations, and so they've managed to make it last a lot longer. I guess it's V6 time then.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, and that's what I find funny about this statement, because they're like, you know, it's not the end of the world. We're recovering some from businesses that go bankrupt and things like that, but maybe we want to start thinking about running some IPv6. Like, that's the tone, isn't it, in this statement?
Yeah, maybe just a little bit. You know, we can't quite carry a NAT away out of this, but, you know, it turns out actually we can.
Yeah, they're like, you know, carrier grade NAT is a thing, but, you know, like V6 also a thing.
Yeah, I do love V6. Man, we shelled so much stuff with V6. It's so great, like a whole nother network, and people don't double, you know, the amount of network security appliances and people and processes they have. They just bolt it on there and let us hackers use it. It's great.
So, look, my question to you, and you've got some experience in sort of telco and ISP land. Do you think we're going to see a meaningful shift now towards V6 adoption, or do you think it's just like IPv4 addresses are going to skyrocket in price?
Yeah, I think the price will go up, and, you know, they've been quite happy deploying carrier NAT. Like, if you were building a new telco now, I mean, you would have to do V6. You wouldn't go pure V4 plus NAT or anything like that now. But, you know, who's going to build a new telco? It's not a significant number of people going to do it. So, I mean, all of the legacy ones, they got loads of address space they can just reuse if they want. And, yeah, the price will go up a bit, and eventually, you know, we'll get V6 out to the handsets and all that kind of thing, and maybe. But, I mean, like, I'm looking at the number of ISPs here in New Zealand, for example, that have deployed V6 and then just kind of given up because no one, you know, just there isn't enough adoption. It's not worth the pain in the ass. And they've turned it off, even though they've already built the infrastructure and deployed it. So,
Maybe we should just make Apple give up its Class A.
Well, exactly, right? I mean, we only have to go and, you know, raid the corpses of a few big corporations, and we get a few slash eights.
So get another 15 years out of it. Fantastic. turning on to what could very well be the comedy story of the week. Remember we spoke a couple of weeks ago about how Facebook suspended the personal accounts of a few people who worked at NSO. They're going to an Israeli court to try to sue Facebook to get their accounts back. And there is a pearler of a quote in this story, which says, "Blocking our private accounts is a hurtful and unjust move by Facebook," the statement said. "The idea that personal data was searched for and used is very disturbing to us." This, of course, a statement from someone who works at NSO Group, makers of spyware that enables precisely that. Crazy times. What do you think?
I mean, it's funny. I mean, on one hand, I could understand, like, they're sad about not being able to post their, you know, lunch on Instagram or whatever. But, you know, tough. You know, you suck it up, buddy, and you work for NSO Group. You don't get to have Instagram. And, you know, honestly, I think that's kind of fair, right? You can't really expect a company whose products that you're using to you know, exploit the user of is going to be happy with you using their platform. I mean, you know, if you did it to Apple, right? I mean, if they were selling Apple bugs on the open market and Apple said, you can't use our phones anymore, well, you know, it'd be kind of fair, you know?
Yeah, I'm all right with that. Like, you know, you got to take the odd poke in the eye, don't you?
If you're going to be in that business, yes.
Yeah, you would think so. Now, speaking of that business, Google has sent 12,000 security warnings out to users in 149 countries, warning them that state-backed attackers are going after their accounts. Interesting, right? Sounds like a big scary number, but it's exactly the same as the same period, same number of warnings as the same period in 2018 and 2017.
Yeah, I mean, this is Google, you know, attempting to correlate when they see emails that have, you know, that they eventually identify as being, you know, kind of nation statey, when they can go back and find out who else has got those. They then send out batches of these warnings. And yeah, the fact that the numbers are kind of constant is, you know, is sort of interesting. It just suggests that, you know, the amount that is going on is probably not too different, or that the amount that Google's able to kind of spot and categorize is, you know, roughly constant. So yeah, it's kind of an interesting number. I mean, certainly if you get one of those emails, it's like, well, then what? I'm sure, you know, there's a bit of confusion there. And Google does have the advanced protection program for people who are being targeted, and, you know, some pretty good 2FA options if you can manage to turn them on and get them all configured right. But yeah, you got to wonder about the people who get those, you know, really what they're going to do about it.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. It doesn't mean they shouldn't send them, though. I mean,
no, of course not. I mean, good job, Google.
Yes, good job, Tag. God, I can't believe we have to have this conversation. Now, yeah, there's all the impeachment hoo-ha in the United States, and a lot of it centers on a call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine. And in the call, he mentions CrowdStrike and Ukraine. And, you know, this is a debunked conspiracy theory that U.S. President Donald Trump seems to genuinely believe in. Someone who I feel doesn't genuinely believe in that conspiracy theory is U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and he is now fronting cameras and saying, yes, well, we need to investigate this stuff, which, you know, I got some real sympathy for people who work at CrowdStrike, particularly the founders right now, because a lot of the people who buy into these theories, they're kind of on the nuts side, right? And you just sort of, you wouldn't feel safe. I wouldn't feel safe if I was those guys right now.
No, you wouldn't, of course. I mean, because the kind of nut jobs that buy this stuff are just, you know, they are dangerous, right? We have seen, you know, real bad things happen, you know, from the scene that follows and believes all this stuff. And, you know, it would be nice if Pompeo would come out and say, oh, well, you know, no, it's debunked, but he can't, right? I mean, he's hitched his horse to that particular wagon,
can't
right?
He really?
Well, he can't. I mean,
yeah, and it's not just him. There's certain Republican lawmakers who are starting to buy into this stuff. What I find genuinely hilarious about this, and I learned this from Kevin Collier's Twitter feed, but he looked it up, and apparently the NRSC and NRCC, you know, these Republican Party organizations, are actually CrowdStrike customers, like pretty significant CrowdStrike customers as well.
So they're like shading as well.
I mean, they're shading CrowdStrike as this Ukrainian business. They're listed on the NASDAQ. I mean, that's the thing about this lie that drives me nuts, is they're talking about it being being owned by a rich Ukrainian. It's a publicly traded company on a US exchange. How is this a conversation that people are having?
Because, look, facts don't matter anymore. It just kind of, it doesn't matter.
But they're so, they're so easily proved. Like,
but that's not relevant. If you don't care about facts, it doesn't matter how easily they're proved. You can just say anything you like. That's the world that we live in now somehow.
I feel like Mugatu, okay? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. It's just, anyway, we're going to have a little break soon. We've got two more episodes after this one to go, and then we're having a little break. I think we need it to wash the stupid off. Anyway, now, one thing that's been happening this year, is pretty interesting, I think, is we saw some leaks out of the Iranian intelligence service to the New York Times and The Intercept, which resulted in some interesting stories over the last couple of weeks. Now we're seeing leaks to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists from China on the issue of the treatment of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. We're starting to see non-Western countries deal with this issue of leaks, and this could get interesting. I have a feeling this might accelerate. Of course, the reason I'm speaking about this is because we've got a story from the BBC here that deals with the ICIJ leaks out of China, which, you know, they reveal all sorts of horrible stuff that we've been speaking about on the podcast for a while now.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the situation inside China and, you know, inside Hong Kong, you know, is a thing that's been of concern to people on the outside, but it really does need solid data from the inside to make good impact in the West. You know, we haven't seen, you know, there's been obviously, you know, news articles and reporting and things and lots of work done, you know, talking about the plight of the Uyghurs, but this kind of data, like straight from, you know, the horse's mouth in this case, like the Chinese Communist Party describing, you know, the processes and the techniques for operating these camps, like that's the sort of thing that does make for more compelling reporting. And yeah, the data is starting to trickle out. Now, whether this is coming from, you know, inside in the Chinese government itself, whether it's people breaking in and then, you know, liberating the data and providing it under whatever cover, you know, we don't really know the origin of this, and I'm sure it will become a bit more clear as the reporters dig through the data and more kind of comes out publicly. But yeah, I mean, how effective some of the leaks we've seen in the West have been in you know, educating the public about what's going on. Yeah, I guess people have taken notice of that. And I mean, we were talking last week about the idea of having, you know, bounties for information, you know, the hackers might go away and get it, right? That's a, you know, this is sort of the world we are heading towards, where access to this kind of information is a thing that's very, very important in shaping these stories. And I think, you know, I'm sure everyone inside Hong Kong is thinking about ways to try and get, you know, more attention paid to the situation there, and you know, this is a good example of the sorts of things that we're going to see more of.
Yeah, Germany has just within the last few days, I believe, fronted the UN and sort of said that UN inspectors should be able to go to these re-education camps and check them out. They want full access. So that's interesting that there's a bit of movement there, and they were citing recent reports. So there you go. Now, look, just while we're on the topic of China, and this is a little bit outside our wheelhouse, but holy God, the China stories coming out of Australia over the last week are amazing.
Yeah, we've seen a series of stories come out after a Chinese intelligence operative, alleged intelligence operative, defected and is starting to talk about, you know, some of the operations that he ran, you know, for the Chinese intel services in Taiwan and, you know, kind of around the region. And some of the reporting here is pretty interesting stuff. And there's, you know, ties back to, in one case, even a plausible assassination of a guy that was asked to kind of cooperate with the Chinese authorities and then went to the Australian intelligence services and told them instead, and he winds up dead a month or two later.
Hang on, I'm gonna stop you there, because it was there's the defector issue, and then there's this other issue, right? And the issue of Nick Zhao, who was a Chinese-Australian car dealer, luxury car dealer, he was apparently approached by Chinese spies, and they offered him $1 million for his campaign to get elected as a Liberal Party member of parliament in the Australian federal election, right? He went to ASIO instead and blew the whistle, and then sometime later turned up dead in a motel room, and which is, you know, that death is now subject to a coronial inquiry. So that's one story. The other story is about this defector who's turned up, and you covered that off nicely. But it's just like when you're here, you know, it's a pretty alarming couple of stories to appear. Of course, China is saying that the guy who is a defector here, I mean, it looks like he didn't hold any sort of rank or anything like that. He was a young guy. He was probably just a fairly junior person, but he's obviously coughed up some good info, because one of the people he named has been arrested in Taiwan.
Yeah, we saw, I think, a couple arrested in Taiwan that were involved with some front company there, and they were involved in political manipulation in the Taiwanese elections as well. So, yeah, it's a really interesting, you know, kind of set of stories, and, you know, sort of the tempo of reporting around Chinese interference in Australian, you know, Australian domestic and international affairs, you know, has been picking up over the last 18 months or so. And I think, you know, everyone inside the intel community you talk to in Australia, you know, basically just says, look, China is all up in all of our things all the time, and I'm sure they're quite glad to see some of this stuff coming out in a more public forum, because the politicians haven't really been pushed into accepting the messages that they're getting from the intel community.
Some of them have. I mean, you know, Andrew Hastie, who chairs the PJCIS, he's been quite vocal, to the point where he was recently, I believe, refused access to China. So,
you know, it's a good start, but I mean, in terms
of delicate. It's delicate. They're our biggest threat, and they're our number one trading partner, right? So try to reconcile that. Yeah, it is a tough place to be. And when you look at our geography, oh my God. Anyway, so just I've dropped links to those stories in this week's show notes, but read them. It's just some real crazy stuff. Okay, moving on. And protests in Iran resulted in the government there essentially just dropping the internet. Now they're approaching like government departments and stuff and asking them what websites they rely on. and people are a little bit scared they're preparing some sort of whitelist. Access looks like it's mostly restored now, but this is becoming the new normal in a lot of these sort of authoritarian countries, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I'm sure it's very distressing for, you know, all of the relatives and, you know, Iranian diaspora around the world trying to get in contact with their family. We've seen a bunch of reports of people using, you know, the classic PSTN to make phone calls in and out. Apparently that still worked. But yeah, I mean, Iran, I guess, has demonstrated that it has the ability to quite effectively control internet access in and out of the country, and, you know, clearly they're going to refine that process further, judging by the, you know, the attempts to build a set of data they might use to make a whitelist.
Yeah, let's see what happens in Iran. I mean, it's just so unpredictable, right?
Well, yeah, and there's so many people with, you know, interests in what happens in Iran and so many fingers in that particular pie. You know, you got to, it's a real mess.
It is. Kevin Rudd, former Australian Prime Minister, says that Julian Assange faces, quote, unacceptable and disproportionate punishment. The political movement in Australia to help Assange is growing, right? And strange bedfellows, right? We've got former Labor Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. We've got ultra-conservatives like George Christensen. We've got former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, all arguing, all making the case. We've got an independent MP, Andrew Wilkie, who's pulling together a coalition of serving politicians to make the case. It really does feel like the espionage charges Assange is facing are a bridge too far for a lot of Australian politicians. So I'm kind of surprised and kind of heartened as well to see this picking up a bit of steam. Meanwhile, our Prime Minister just doesn't want to have a bar of it, right? He's already written back to Pamela Anderson saying, no, I'm not going to help, which is just such a 2019 thing to say. But what's your take on this?
Well, I mean, you can kind of see their point, right? I mean, you know, he obviously the situation he would face in the US is going to be pretty extreme, and you know, there's plenty of countries that don't want their citizens extradited to, you know, elsewhere to face punishments that would be quite materially different than what they would necessarily face at home. And that's not an unreasonable position to have. I mean, you know, and yeah, I mean, much as you don't want to agree with a bunch of obnoxious conservative politicians, and much as, you know, we're not huge fans of Assange on the show, you can kind of see the argument for it. And
oh, look,
you
know, I have no problem saying that I do not believe he should be extradited to face those particular charges. If it was just a CFAA thing, hey, go for it, you know, give him his day in court. But this other stuff, it has the potential to criminalize news gathering.
Well, yeah, right. The intersection with actual news gathering certainly is a thing of concern, and there's just such a wide range of disproportionate sorts of punishments for this sort of thing in the US that, yeah, you can't really trust the Americans to not cock it up. So
yeah, well, and that's the thing. If he does wind up just being deported to Australia, we are the ones who will suffer the sentence of watching him doing television appearances and speeches at writers' festivals until he dies. That will be Julian Assange's future, I believe.
I mean, it's a living, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, there's plenty of people who do it. The New York Post reports that the NYPD's fingerprint database, it's a little bit unclear from the story, but it looks like it nearly got ransomwared and they had to pull it down because a contractor plugged something bad into the network and things were starting to light on fire, so they pulled the pin. Looks like they dodged a bullet here, but it's still pretty funny.
Yeah, the reporting's a little bit confused. It says that they're, you know, basically they detected some malware on their network that was ransomware-y and that it had been, I think, stored on a file server, or it had made its way to another machine where it was near the fingerprint database and it got detected but hadn't executed. So it's not clear whether it was just files being stored somewhere or whether there was running malware and the actual ransomware component hadn't been triggered. But they're attributing it to a contractor who had plugged in some, like, Intel NUC, you know, little embedded computer. And the question, of course, then I ask as well, some random Intel NUC that some guy brought in isn't going to have domain creds, so how did it get the files onto the file server wherever it was going? So there's a little bit of detail we don't know, but either way, the fact that they did not get their entire police department ransomware, I guess, is a good news story.
It is, unlike these nursing homes in the United States. This is, I mean, come on. We're talking about all these stories. It's hospitals, schools, police stations, and now nursing homes. Veterinarian clinics. Was that last week or the week before? And now nursing homes. Yeah. 110 nursing homes got cut off from their sort of managed service provider because of a ransomware attack.
Yeah, this was a company called Virtual Care Provider Inc. that provided kind of like Citrix-based hosted services for, you know, nursing homes and acute care facilities. And yeah, they got completely re-ooked. All of their stuff's offline, all their data's locked up, you know, and there's going to be clinics and care homes that are, you know, may even go out of business because they can't get their, you know, their funding money arranged or whatever it happens to be, you know, because of ransomware. And that's just, I mean, yeah, what do you even say to that, right? It's a terrible situation to be in. And yet, on the other hand, you know, if you're going to run a piece of infrastructure that, you know, kind of looks after important data, maybe you could, you know, invest in some security controls that actually work.
Yeah, and I think...
I don't want to victim blame. It's not their fault, but...
We have signed up, I think, for a snake oiler slot or something next year, a company that actually makes MSP software. And you can always tell, right? Like a vendor, when they're just itching, keep writing in, saying, can we come on your show? Can we come on your show? It's because they've got something that probably, I'm guessing, is designed to address this, right? So the tools are out there. It's just people aren't using them.
Well, I mean, you know, it is hard, right, to run networks well, but yeah. I mean,
it's not hard to run them so that things don't, you know, the whole thing doesn't burst into flames at once, right?
Yeah, at least having backups so you can say, hey, sorry, we're terrible, we suck, here's a copy of your data on tape from 6 months ago, you know, it's better than nothing, right?
Yeah.
Not even being in a position to do that, which it appears that they're not. Like, that's, you know, not great.
Yeah. Yeah. Just briefly, apparently over 480 million mobile VPN apps have been downloaded in the past year, according to this story from Catalin Kimpanu. The reason I find this interesting is when you look at the geographic spread of where those downloads are occurring, it actually looks like a lot of them are being downloaded in places where it makes sense to download them.
Yeah, I think number one on the list is for growth is Indonesia, which of course we've seen a bunch of discussion there about, you know, kind of changes to censorship rules for internet access and things. So I imagine VPN access pretty popular there. Something like, what, 70 million downloads in 12 months of VPN software in a country that has, what, 200 and something million people? Like, that's saying something.
According to their census, which I've never... both as children lived in Indonesia for a while, and you know, how would you count that place? Like,
records keeping, not their strong point.
Really. That's right.
Of course, the question I do have is whether or not they're downloading good VPN apps, or in fact, whether there is a good VPN app, or whether you're just kind of trading one set of being observed by a government for a whole other different set of them. But yeah,
well, it's like you choose whether or not your behavior, you know, your behavioral data goes to a law enforcement and, you know, correctness of thought bureaucracy, or whether it goes to some company that's going to try to sell your shoes.
Yeah, exactly, right? That's, or, you know, bulletproof hosting in Russia, or, and everybody who's compromised the bulletproof hosting with the VPN runs, et cetera. But yes, you're right, you're making a trade-off, but I just don't know how many people understand that that's the trade-off that they're making.
No,
right?
Probably not. Yeah, there we are. I guess it's worth mentioning someone's going around hijacking Docker boxes with exposed API endpoints. They're dropping Monero miners on them. I mean, this is not exactly surprising news.
Well, this is just funny because people are like, what they're doing here is they're hitting the Docker infrastructure and then like loading a new Docker container, running the Monero miner. So just like kind of adding another one to your list and stealing a CPU and mining stuff, which is, that's pretty funny.
It is. I mean, the funny, man, I published a soapbox yesterday with Trend, and I'm talking to the Trend cloud guy, right? And he's like, yeah. So, and I'm like, what are you even doing in the cloud? You're Trend. And he's like, it turns out a fair bit, right? But the funniest part is where he's going, yeah, so we do a bit of AV scanning on Docker images. And I'm like, why on earth would you need to scan containers for malware? And he's like, because like most of them are full of Monero miners. And I'm like... That's actually a good point, and I hate it. I hate that that's a good point, but geez, it is. You see? I mean, I'm sure you, when I was saying that, you probably had the same thought. Why would you fire a scan?
Oh. Well, exactly, and why would you? But sure, okay, yeah, fine. You know,
well, when you download it, you know, what is it, like 50% of containers on Docker Hub are all got Monero miners in them, so you know, you kind of need your AV scanning.
Yeah, I mean, AV in the cloud has two, as far as I see, it has two purposes. One, Monero miners, and the other is so the pen testers can upload iCar and have a laugh when things stop working. So, you know, it's good for something.
What do we got here? Another one from Catalin. Apparently some cheap kids GPS tracking smartwatch out of China. Surprise, surprise, not very good. And some research was done into that. And then, you know, they could actually find all of the kids who are wearing these watches. This isn't really what you want when you buy that sort of product.
No, I mean, and to a certain extent, if you buy a $35 smartwatch, you know, there's a kind of an expectation that it's not going to be particularly good, and security is absolutely one of the places where they can save money. And for $35, you don't get any security. It turns out in this case, like the mobile app that you pair with the phone so that you can like talk to your kid through it and GPS track them. Like you could just pair with anybody's kid and then talk to them or track them or whatever. It's pretty gross. But for $35, I don't know what you expected.
Yeah. Joseph Cox has belted out a yarn over at Vice, and the headline reads, the California DMV is making $50 million a year selling drivers' personal information. Now, it's interesting, right, because the story actually outlines a few cases where that info could be quite valuable to people in a non-privacy invading way, right? So, for example, a look at the Takata recall, right, the airbag recall. You know, you're going to need that DMV data to do a recall like that. You might want to get some intelligence on how many of the cars you sold in California as a car maker are still on the road, things like that. So there are insights to be gleaned from this data that aren't creepy, but there's also nothing here that suggests that they're not also doing the creepy stuff, like selling it off to bounty hunters, which some DMVs do, things like that. But look, you know, Joe's been doing a great job over the last year or so exploring these types of issues, and it's a good write-up.
Yeah, it is. It is a good write-up. And, I mean, you're right. There's some legit uses for the data. He does appear to have suggestion that they did, in fact, sell it to bounty hunters at some point. He's not necessarily saying they've done so recently. But, I mean, that's the sort of thing that you would imagine Americans would do, you know, sell driver's license data to bounty hunters. Because, hey, why not? You know, and that sort of stuff just doesn't seem acceptable. I mean, you know, obviously there's legitimate reasons for access to the data for law enforcement and, you know, all sorts of things like that. But, you know, selling it to bounty hunters, really, I mean, I know it's the American way, but...
Well, it's not clear from this story whether or not that's actually happening in California. It has happened in other places, though. But, yeah, I mean, if they can make $50 million by selling non-identifying information to car makers and identifying information in the case of recalls and things like that, I don't have a problem with it. But the problem is, isn't it, that none of this stuff is appropriately regulated.
No, and it kind of does need to be, especially in cases where you are kind of compelled to provide this data, like where, you know, it's not like you have an option to not engage with the system, you know, unless, well, I suppose car ownership is a thing pretty much mandatory in the US. You know, you don't have an option to opt out of this. Like, it's just kind of not reasonable that data can then be sold on, you know, for profit to private sector organizations unless there's some really good reason for it. And bounty hunting just kind of doesn't seem like one.
We got a couple of stories from Lily Hay Newman at Wired to talk about this week. This first one is an interesting little feature called The Debate Over How to Encrypt the Internet of Things. And really what it boils down to is, you know, do you want to use AES on Internet of Things devices, or should we be rolling out some sort of standardized lightweight encryption?
Which is, you know, it's a good question to ask. I mean, you know, IoT devices do have limited compute, limited memory, limited power. You know, doing heavyweight desktop-grade ciphers on these things, you know, does come at a cost. And where people invent their own low-power, you know, low CPU ciphers, you know, there's a chance they're going to mess it up. We have seen some work to build, you know, either optimized versions of AES, optimized implementations of AES, you know, that are friendly to low-power devices, or, you know, small crypto algorithms that at least provide some controls. But on the other hand, is crypto really the problem with IoT devices? Well, no, it's not, right? I mean, that's not, you know, of the problems that face that ecosystem, you know, the actual crypto algorithm is kind of like 5-10%.
Well, but think long-term. Think long-term, man. Come on.
I mean, you've still got to identify who you're talking to, and that's the kind of more heavyweight cryptographic side of it rather than the stream cipher that's encrypting stuff on the wire. So there's kind of, you know, there's just a whole bunch of other problems to solve, you know, before the algorithm was the poor choice, because how many IoT devices are hacked by crypto, right? Not a whole bunch.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a good argument.
But I guess it's just the proliferation issue, right? Because this stuff is everywhere, and it's going to be even more everywhere in the future. And it's probably something that we, you know, because you got to address it now. You can't address it later. You can't retrofit this stuff. That's why I'm kind of sympathetic to this being a valid discussion.
No, I mean, it certainly is a valid discussion. It's just, you know, it's one part of the overall ecosystem, right? I mean, because crypto is only a very small, you know, itty-bitty piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. The second story from Lily that we're talking about this week is, you know, another example of a massive database featuring scraped information on 1.2 billion records in this database, just sort of popping up on the internet and being accessible to everyone. You know, this isn't breach data, but still, it's just, we live in a world where people can pull together databases of 1.2 billion records and just throw it on some AWS box.
Yeah, which is, you know, what's happened here. It's a couple of researchers rummaging around, found this data set lying around the network, did some work to figure out, where it had actually come from. And it turned out it was a collection of data from a few commercial data brokers that presumably someone had either bought or helped themselves to, probably cheaper to buy it than hack them, and then, you know, put that all together in one place. And it's just kind of an indicator of, you know, what you can do with commercially available data sets. You know, when you've got someone who's done all the hard work of, you know, scraping LinkedIn and scraping Facebook and scraping Twitter and pulling it together and correlating that with other data sources. You're right. All of that information, when it's in one place, is more powerful than when you have to go do it yourself.
The non-profit organization Voting Works has teamed up with the US Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, to open source an election auditing tool, which is a great move, right? Transparency around election security is very important, and probably the most important security control that you can have in an election is decent post-election auditing.
Yeah, and it makes sense to do this, you know, in an open way with open source software and with a process that's kind of, you know, people can look at and explain and understand how it works. And so this is a software tool that's designed specifically for the US election process and for figuring out, you know, which votes need to be audited, for providing information about how to go and find the actual ballots, you know, from whatever storage they're in, and, you know, give instructions so that they can do that post-election auditing process, you know, smoothly and efficiently, and, you know, with all of the appropriate kind of documentation and stuff. So yeah, seems like a pretty smart thing to throw up on GitHub for everyone to have a look at and kind of poke at and think about. And yeah, it seems like a good idea.
Woe is Kazakhstan, Adam. Woe is Kazakhstan. We've talked a bit about stuff going on there, but I suppose when you're wedged between Russia and China, you're going to get owned a fair bit, and that's what's happening right now. Chihu360 published the report. All about various sort of APT-style activity happening in Kazakhstan. A lot of this activity involving radio interception gear and whatnot. Like, it suggests a well-funded adversary. And the fact that Chihu360 is the one releasing the report tends to suggest that perhaps the suspect here is not China. But it's a good write-up, this one.
Yeah, it is. It's a good write-up of this the Golden Falcon crew that's been operating in Kazakhstan. And, I mean, as you say, right, it's between China and Russia, you know, there's interests in both, and this particular crew was seen targeting not only Kazakh interests, but also, you know, some of Chinese people, some Chinese operations, you know, in the region near Kazakhstan, which kind of suggests maybe it's the other direction Russia involved, although, you know, analysts who've been asked about these things, like, there's no real solid attribution, but people seem to say, you know, like, either it's the Russians or it's a Russian private sector group kind of contracting the Kazakhs to spy on their own people, or it's the Kazakhs spying on their own people. But yeah, they seem relatively well funded, right? They've got tools from Hacking Team post breach.
Yeah, that's right. That's the other data point, isn't it? They can afford to buy the 24 karat exploits.
Yeah, but, you know, buy reasonable tools, buy radio intercept gear, you know.
Hang on. You said Hacking Team and I said 24 karat. I mean the sterling silver exploits.
Saying, oh dear. There was also some contracts, I think, for them talking to NSO Group, although there didn't seem to be any direct evidence. I think Kihu360 had owned one of the C2 boxes and they found like contracts and stuff for them, you know, like talking to NSO.
They left that on the C2.
Well, I mean, doesn't seem like the world's best operation, to be honest. Either that or Kihu owned further up the chain than exactly what they said, and we're meant to read between the lines. I don't know. But yeah, the fact that you've got radio intercept gear does imply a certain kind of, you know, being physically present on the ground, operating in country, which, you know, makes it perhaps the locals, I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? But either way, people getting owned and there's money being spent on it. Owned. And if you live in Kazakhstan,
getting owned.
Getting owned, basically. The Defense Department in the United States is getting the shits with the FCC because it says certain frequency ranges that are about to be offered for 5G use will interfere with things that the DoD kind of relies on, like, you know, GPS.
Yeah, there's an application with the FCC to relicense portions of the L band around the kind of, you know, 1 to 2 gigahertz range for use for 5G land mobile. The DoD, of course, has some concerns about specifically GPS, one example, but there's a bunch of other military systems, you know, IFF, friend or foe identification systems and other telemetry things and, you know, landing assistance, all sorts of, you know, interesting military stuff in that range, which in their defense, they have moved around, you know, a few times in the past because of the encroachment of commercial radio operations in those bands. But GPS, a little bit more difficult
to move around. A little bit more costly to do that.
A little bit more, yes.
Yeah. Interesting side note here, and this was something that I read about at the time, but, you know, NASA, the US Navy and the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration had also been quite upset over the release of spectrum in the 24 gigahertz range, because that's really going to interfere with weather satellites, because that's the frequency that they use to detect water vapor in the atmosphere. So that one I'm really surprised got through, because that could be pretty bad, right?
Yeah, although the FCC under this administration does seem to be kind of a bunch of dicks, so, yeah. You know.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see, yeah. Is there a cyclone coming? No idea. Can't see it. Yeah, let's see. But obviously, I know nothing about weather measurement, so maybe it's all fine. Let's see. This is a weird one. I just wanted to include it because it's weird. We've got Ars Technica reporting that scammers are trying a new way to steal online shoppers' payment card data, and the story says that instead of directing them to the correct third-party payment processor, they're directing them to a fraudulent third-party payment processor. This is not a new thing.
No, I'm pretty sure this has been going on for quite some time. I mean, the only thing that seemed to be new in this particular case was they were using the Australian Commonwealth Bank's payment processor, you know, kind of branding and stuff. But yeah, other than that, I mean, asking people to type their credit card numbers into a thing that looks like the thing they expect to type their credit card number into, not really super new.
Yeah. One interesting thing here, and I don't know if they've changed the domain, but the domain on the fake, like, processing gateway is payment-mastercard.com, which is fully TLS encrypted, and you just think, wow, like, how did that happen?
Well, and the funny thing is, right, they've got in the Ars piece, they've got a side-to-side comparison of the fake one and the real one, and honestly, the domain of the fake one looks more legit than the domain of the real one, which, of course, has all sorts of, you know, garbage JSession IDs and stuff from the rubbish Java backend that makes it work. So, yeah, like, the fake one totally looks more legit.
Yeah, it does. It does. oh, interesting court decision in the United States. A suspect in a child exploitation material case has refused to reveal a 64-character password because he's saying, you know what's on there. I'm not going to reveal that because that's going to incriminate me. And the courts have, it's Pennsylvania's highest court, have agreed with him. This is not its first time in the courts, but they've agreed with him and said that this is a Fifth Amendment problem.
Yeah, which, I mean, this is a debate that's been going on for, you know, I guess as long as people have been refusing to hand over their passwords to law enforcement. And, I mean, you know, you can see both sides of the argument, but, I mean, you know, Americans do like not self-incriminating, and, you know, giving up your password does seem pretty self-incriminatory, so kind of makes sense. But whether or not this ends up going further up the court chain in the US, we have to assume it's probably going to go further and further. Maybe it'll end up with an actual Supreme Court as opposed to just Pennsylvania. But yeah,
well, it kind of feels like it needs to go there, right? Because we're having this big debate about encryption as well. And, you know, if there's not going to be legislation requiring some sort of assisted access to fully encrypted devices, you would think that maybe introducing a penalty for people who refuse to unlock devices under warrant might be appropriate, right? But then it's all going to come down to constitutional interpretation and blah, 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 blah. It's complicated is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, this just seems like an American problem. And, you know, over here, we're probably going to get compelled to hand over our passphrases because we've got the Westminster statutes instead. And they do not protect us quite so much.
We got a great write-up here from Jeff Stone at Cyberscoop about Alexei Berkov's court appearance in which he pleaded not guilty. Just a beautiful colour piece, this one.
Yeah,
and this
nice.
Is, of course, sorry, I should mention that this is the guy that we spoke about last week where there's been this ongoing battle. You know, Russia didn't want to see him extradited from Israel to the United States, and there's been a lot of hoo-ha going on that one. And, yeah, the colour in this piece is great. Like, there were even, you know, Russian embassy officials in the courtroom and stuff like that.
Yeah, chatting with the defence attorney, and, apparently the judge made some wisecrack in Russian about ice cream to the guy, and they had a jolly laugh about it. So, yeah, anyway, he's pled not guilty for now, so we'll see where this particular one goes. But yeah, it's kind of nice to add a bit of flavor to proceedings.
Yeah, and it's a good write-up, this one, that gives some good background. So if you're interested in that one, I would recommend reading that one this week. It'll be in this week's show notes. What else have we got? Oh yeah, the guy, a member of the group that owned Jack Dorsey's Twitter account has been arrested. Joe Cox has this story for Vice, but they haven't named him because, of course, he's a minor.
He's a minor because, well, let's face it, doing a little sim hijacking, not that difficult, doesn't require, you know, grown-up skills. Anyone can do it, apparently. But, yeah, it's kind of, you got to wonder, you know, Hacking Crew giving interviews to the media is always a bit of a messy situation. But, yeah, Mr. Debug, of the chuckling squad reports that this guy got kicked out of the hacking team at some point after this occurred. And yeah, now he's gone down and hopefully he won't rat you out, Mr. Debug.
There you go. And meanwhile, Twitter has actually made some changes so that now you can use 2FA, like with a security key or an application code generator, and not have to store the phone number, which I thought I got working a while ago. Now it's just telling me that this is only possible now. So I went to check in my Twitter settings, and Twitter had by itself helpfully disabled all of my two-factor authentication for some reason. So thanks, guys. Good job. We got a fun one here. Apache Solr, which is apparently like a search engine for Apache. There was a bug disclosed in it that the maintainers didn't think was a big deal. Turns out, kind of was a big deal.
Yeah, Apache Solr is surprisingly widely used. It's a kind of standalone search engine that got donated by CNET, of all places, into the Apache project at some point in the 2000s and has kept on going. And it's behind the search engine for a whole bunch of places. Yeah, bug in this case is if you can talk to some particular high port, then you can turn on some dangerous features and then leverage that into remote code exec. And the original report didn't really make it clear that that's what you could do. Subsequent proof of concept show that you can turn on a templating feature, which then lets you exec arbitrary code. And there's nicely packaged exploits on GitHub for you to use now. Most people, hopefully, who run Solr have firewalled this particular port anyway.
Well, port 8983, like who sets it up and goes, geez, that should be on the internet.
That sounds legit. But on the other hand, I suspect this bug is going to be reachable through service side request forgery, which of course is a really common bug class.
I was thinking the same thing, right? Like if you can trigger a request, right? Like that's going to be gold.
Yeah, so I mean the requests that you use to set up and exploit this vuln are HTTP, so yes, you should be able to make them with a service side request forgery bug, and that's going to be pretty common in the sorts of places that run Apache Solr. So like this is a great bug. I imagine that we'll probably shell some people with it, to be honest.
Now this next one, it's not so much a bug as a finding. And it is definitely our skateboarding dog of the week story. I've seen news reports on this one popping up, but I first saw it on Twitter. It's glorious. Fortinet, you idiots.
Oh, God, such morons. So this is a bug report that popped up from some research done by Sec Consult. They identified that many Fortinet products will communicate back to Fortinet Central to do some, you know, kind of AV scanning or cloud, threat feedy stuff when you're using their, like, web filtering product and that kind of thing. Anyway, the requests made by the thing that's doing the intercepting and then talking off back to Fortinet Central are XORed with a fixed key, which, of course, means that fixed key is trivial to recover, and then an attacker who's on the wire between the Fortinet appliance and Fortinet Central can recover a bunch of things, including if you're doing TLS intercept, like the contents of the URL that's being browsed to by the end user, which if it contains session key material in the URL, it's probably enough to go and hijack their sessions and a bunch of other stuff, and you can interfere with that. Anyway, that's funny enough, you know, hard-coded crypto key, hard-coded XOR crypto key, you know, you don't even need the key at that point if you can see multiple requests. So that's funny. But the subsequent funniness, the second degree funniness, is the advisory. This has taken them like almost 2 years to responsibly disclose since they first tried explaining it to Fortinet cert. So that didn't go well for them. And then the final crowning, you know, kind of cherry on top of this particular advisory is they've redacted the XOR key from the exploit example script that they provide in their advisory. And then they include, here is some sample data, and here is the plain text, which is the researchers from Sec Consult very carefully saying to us, here is the key that we agreed not to give you.
And pray tell, what is that key, Adam?
And so, yes, the little key is a little bit of left-right keyboard mashing. If you pump that particular string into Google, you'll find that it falls out of several EXEs that are part of Fortinet's products. So, yes, good job. Hard-coded key made up by some developer mashing keys that you've been spraying over the internet for years as part of your security product. Good job. Good job, Fortinet.
It's been a while since we've heard from the sad trombone, but, you know, I feel in this instance it's justified. Adam, that is it for this week's news. Thank you very much for joining us. We only get to do this two more times this year, and then we go on break. But it's been a real pleasure, and I'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, Pat. I'll talk to you next week.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. And don't forget, Adam is with Insomnia Security in New Zealand. Do contact them for all your security consulting and pen testing needs. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Sally Carson from Duo Security. Sally has been a designer for over 20 years. She joined Duo in 2015 and built the company's product design and user research practice from the ground up. The company now employs one designer for every 5 users, which is an extremely generous ratio when you compare it to other companies in this industry. Now, as you'll hear, Sally thinks empathy is the key to designing usable technology. She joined me for this interview, and here's what she had to say.
We do a lot of research into who are the people that are going to be using Duo. And so that is, you know, the largest population of people that are impacted by our product is that end user, you know. So it's a really interesting use case where generally those people, this product is being foisted upon them. They're not necessarily opting in. They might be an employee at a big organization, and that organization is saying, hey, this is something you need to do now. We're going to 2-factor in when you're logging into systems. It's just going to be part of your workflow day to day. So they have their own sort of considerations that we need to take into account when we're designing software. They're not the buyer, and they're not the one rolling out and administering the product. They're on the receiving end. So that's one interesting take. And then we also do a lot of research into, you know, who are the, let's say, IT administrators that are often deploying our software, and what are their needs? How do we make it incredibly easy to run a proof of concept, to deploy more widely within the organization, and then to manage it from there? And then we have folks like CISOs. Like, they need to understand what's the return on investment when they decide to deploy budget to roll out Duo, and is it resulting in better security outcomes for their organization? So there's a lot of different angles that we think about.
Now, you joined Duo in 2015 and built the product design and user research practice. You built that there. And now You've got like a ratio of, what's the ratio again? You've got X number of designers for Y number of engineers?
Yeah, we have roughly one designer for every developer. And I would say like developer roughly for like a dev who's touching front end code.
So what were the early challenges, right? When you joined in 2015, you know, you're coming in as a designer, you're coming in as a user experience expert. Did you look at some of the things that Duo was doing and just going, oh my, you know, we're going to have to change that, you know, get out the red pen?
Well, it was such a cool organization to join. For me as a designer, I couldn't resist because I had known Doug, our then CEO, for many years, and he had been a mentor to me and an advisor to my startup. So I'd been aware of Duo for almost since the inception. In fact, I sat next to Duo when it was an initial group of 5 people next to them at a co-working space in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I had seen them build the product from the earliest days, and what was really unique about Duo was the customer centricity and the user-centered design, that lens through which they were building security products. It was really baked in from day one. So talk about an incredible opportunity to enter an organization as a design leader. I didn't have to really do a lot of convincing to say, hey, we should consider the customer. You know, we should really speak to customers. They were already doing all of that. And so then what I could do is bring in a little bit of a more structured methodology around some of the product development practices and build out from there.
Yeah, so I guess it was more about future stuff than necessarily fixing past grave mistakes.
Yeah, I didn't have to shift the culture. Like, the culture was already so aligned around serving the needs of customers based on what we know about their behavior. And that's just like really fertile soil for building a healthy design practice.
Do you think there are lessons that people can take away from your experience with Duo? And can they take those some lessons you've learned and apply them to not necessarily product design contexts, but other contexts within their organization when they're dealing with security? Because it sounds like really it's about having some empathy for the users who are having your technology foisted upon them. There's got to be some teachable moments in there.
Yeah, for sure. And I was just revisiting your episode with Wendy Nather, our head of advisory CISOs here at Duo. And she used this phrase of victim shaming, which I find so interesting because in the user experience profession, we have this concept of don't blame the user. It's very much the same idea. So what we try to do is really observe real actual human behavior, do work to understand their underlying motivation and goals behind that behavior. And then from there, try to shape products or experiences to align with what those people are trying to achieve, as opposed to kind of hammering them with the product that we've built and blaming them when they don't understand it. We, as product developers, we take a lot of responsibility for whether or not that product or service is successful. So like you're saying, it takes a lot of empathy. And in order to build that empathy, you have to either spend a lot of time speaking with your customers, observing them, interviewing them. There's all these qualitative research methods that we use to get a really, really rich understanding of who these folks are and what they're trying to achieve.
One thing that comes to mind, right, when I think about like just minor UX tweaks that have made such a difference, and this is kind of a security one, you know, how many years was it before a computer would tell you that you'd left caps lock on when you were trying to type your password?
Right.
How many years did of productivity, right, was lost by people retyping passwords with caps lock on? I mean, it's all going to be huge amounts of research and thinking to get to small little breakthroughs, isn't it?
Yes, it's so true. Like, you know, it takes an incredible amount of work to reduce complexity and make something feel very seamless and very simple. You wouldn't think it. Like, if the net result is something that's very smooth and simple, you would think it was kind of easy to develop. But oftentimes there's just a ton of research and investigation, exploration, experimentation that goes into delivering something to the market that's super simple.
Can you give us an example of a sort of breakthrough, of a eureka moment that you may have had when working with Duo and there was an issue that you were able to solve from a design point of view? Because I'd imagine there would have been certain things to do with workflow where you would have just had that eureka moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's countless. I mean, they happen on the micro and on the macro. Like sometimes, I'm trying to think of a good specific right now, but sometimes we reveal something that kind of counters a fundamental assumption about the whole approach to our product strategy. And that's kind of interesting. Sometimes it's much more minute, you know, sometimes it's just about discoverability of a label or making sure that a call to action matches the headline, you know, the header on the subsequent page, simple kind of like low hanging fruit.
Yeah. Like just making things consistent. Error messages that are in English, you know, or in meaningful, a language at least, you know?
Yeah, meaningful error messages, just simple things like that. And it's kind of surprising how often, you know, security software does fall short on things that when you come from a UX practice are kind of low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, G Suite's the worst, man. Like you get errors that just say there was an error.
Yeah, like, thanks. And you know what's funny? Yeah, it's really funny. I kind of like exploring those weird little dusty corners of G Suite because I have the sense that either I'm hitting an organizational boundary. It's like, oh, I can feel now that I've leapt into this team that's responsible for this flow. It feels very different. Or I can feel the sort of like the backlog or the roadmap. This has clearly not been prioritized over here, but they've done a lot of polish over here.
Look, I think a designer spending their time exploring the dark recesses of G Suite, that feels a little bit like masochism to me.
Yeah, a little bit. It's fascinating though.
So a moment ago, I asked you if you had any specific examples of where you've had some of these eureka moments. Can you think of any specifics?
Yeah, there's one. I can't give all the details about it, but it was a really interesting case study where we did a little bit of research trying to understand, you know, how and why our customers use some competitive tool that they're using today. And we made some fundamental underlying assumptions about like, oh, they're going to do this core behavior because it's the quicker, easier way to do things. And we sent a design researcher into the field to observe and to do some interviews. And what we found was, you know, whether it was our product or competitor's product, the customers were actually totally circumventing what we assumed was this core workflow that we had assumed was there because it made things easier for them. And they were actually like circumventing and finding a completely different way to achieve what they were doing. And that was just like revelatory for us because it totally changed the way that we thought about building out that product and just led us on a different path completely. But we wouldn't have had that insight, yeah, without the research.
One of my favorite design stories is when Toyota started Lexus. They actually dispatched a bunch of engineers and designers to the United States to live in California and observe Americans in their natural habitat. You know,
really?
And I just got, yeah, they did. And I just got that same vibe when you're talking about sending people in to observe, right? It's got a real David Attenborough, you know.
Yeah, that's so true. And we do borrow a lot from the field of anthropology.
Yeah.
You might also sometimes hear Wendy Nather say security anthropology. It's something I hear Doug say sometimes as well. But we have run what we call ethnography programs where we send our teams. And it might even include, it's often led by a design researcher, but they'll bring in our product designers, our engineers, and our product managers as well. We'll send a team on site to a number of different customers' locations into their office just to, not to interview, not to do structured interviews, but just to be a fly on the wall and do some observational research. Yeah. Just to see, you know, what is all the tooling that they're stringing together? How many tabs do they have open? Are they actually having to run across their campus or their building to achieve some task that we thought that they were doing digitally? You know, are there the cliches? Are there post-its with passwords on the monitor? Just any of these observations. We even had one where we went on site to a customer office and we were observing the, I think it was the help desk administrators. And we noticed that there were posters on the walls with headshots of each of the help desk team with stats about sort of like their turnaround time for tickets and how responsive they were. And so not only were they being measured and incentivized for how responsive they were, it was displayed in a very public view. It was just in the corridor, in the way into their little cluster of cubicles. So that type of thing is really insightful. And we pull a lot of those insights into the way that we develop product from there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I was just thinking, what a sign of late capitalism. Those set of posters. It's a little bit depressing.
Here's your score.
Here's your score. Here is your value on a poster. Oh,
we're kindred spirits, Patrick. I love taking a jab at late capitalism on this podcast. That's great.
So, how many security companies do you think actually spend the time to send designers to go and observe people using their products? Because that just seems like an eminently sensible thing to do that I have a feeling nobody does.
Yeah, it's really unique. It's really unique in the security space. And, you know, a lot of my background, I've been in tech for 20 years and my career, a lot of the early parts of my career, I spent in consumer web and e-commerce and social. And that kind of research was baked in. I mean, we, you know, like working at Yahoo Sports back in the day, we did a lot of ethnography. We built out a persona where I think our core user persona, the assumption was that they were a little bit drunk because they'd come home from work, pop a couple of beers, you know, talk trash with their friend while they're playing fantasy football. So these kinds of like human insights and behavioral insights are very much baked into product development for consumer web, but I think it's kind of novel to pull it into enterprise security. It's something pretty new, and I think we're blazing a trail at Duo, but it's so important to this work because we understand now that security is, you know, fundamentally a human problem. Like if you understand the ways that most breaches are originated, it has to do with human behavior. So that reveals like a huge opportunity for design and user research to have impact.
Well, I think you've made a very, very compelling pitch for, I suppose, you know, security toolmakers to go and spend a bit of time thinking about design and maybe observing some users and building some feedback there. Sally Carson, it's been a real pleasure to chat to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
That was Sally Carson of Duo Security there with a chat about design. Big thanks to her for that, and big thanks to Duo for its support over the years, and huge congratulations to the team there for its success being acquired by Cisco for a lot of cashola. That is a great result. The reason I mention that is because Duo will not be returning to Risky Business in 2020. Doing business with huge companies like Cisco is, you know, kind of a drag, and demand for sponsor slots is insane right now. So basically what happened is we just filled up with other vendors before we were motivated enough to become an approved supplier to Cisco. So that is the honest and boring reason why they won't be back next year. They've supplied us with some terrific interviews and content over the years, particularly the Soapbox episodes, the WebAuthn episode. It's one of my all-time favorite soapboxes. Really great stuff. So they will be missed, but I'm sure we will find ways to do stuff with Duo again in the future. Now, before we sign off this week, I'm going to do something I haven't done in a long while and play a feature track. Maybe more recent listeners wouldn't know that that's something I used to do in every episode. Melbourne singer and songwriter Dan Knight sadly passed away recently, a few weeks ago. He was an absolutely incredible keyboard player. He played keyboards for Renee Geyer, James Rain, Kate Sobrano. These are very famous Australian artists for people who are listening outside Australia. So he played with people like that, among others. He was also an amazing vocalist and songwriter. He wrote songs with and for all sorts of bands and artists. He did TV commercial music as well a long time ago. And the point that I'm driving at here is you've probably heard Dan's music even if you don't know who he is. You know, I personally think he was as talented as anyone he worked with, maybe more. But Dan had a bit of a self-destructive streak that that undermined his career. He was a complicated guy. I really liked him, but he was complicated. I knew Dan in my late teens and early 20s, but we'd only spoken a couple of times in the last 20 years. And the last time we spoke, maybe a year or two ago, I could tell he wasn't doing that well. But look, after he died, a band he worked with called Vaudeville Smash, they posted this song to their Facebook page. It's an unreleased song Dan wrote, then recorded with a criminally noisy microphone. It's called Baby Jesus, and it's dark, whimsical, sad, and beautiful all at once. He was a very talented guy. I do hope you enjoy this song. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Baby Jesus, where's your light? I'm alone, I'm alone, I'm alone tonight. No one's calling, darkness falling, need some light. Keep on fighting this fight. Can you make it all right tonight? I don't want to be a burden on your tiny mind. The baby go. I'm sure that you know it. And if Mary and Joseph don't mind, we will be fine. We'll drink lots of wine. So baby Jesus, leave that say goodbye to the sheep and cows, goodbye to the three wise men, goodbye to the spirit in the sky, to your life of pain, goodbye to the loaves and fishes, by to the Romans say goodbye, to frankincense and myrrh, and the things you never were, and the straw and shit, goodbye. Won't you say goodbye and come with me?